Welcome back to Psychedelic Therapy Frontiers, the podcast devoted to exploring the frontiers of psychedelic medicine and what it takes to cultivate a healthy mind, body, and spirit. I'm Dr. Steve Thayer, and today my co-host, Dr. Reid Robison, and I tackle the topic of people-pleasing. Reid and I confess our own personal struggles with people-pleasing and what we've done to try to mitigate it. We explore the relationship between people-pleasing and attachment styles, why being nice isn't always so nice, how to set better boundaries, how self-compassion can help heal the wounds that lead to maladaptive people-pleasing, why selfishness can be a good thing, and much, much more. A couple of announcements for you. If any of you are listening to this show and looking for good training and education pursuant to becoming a psychedelic therapist, check out Numinous' programs. You can click on the link in the show notes or go directly to numinous.com/our-training-selection and use the code PTF10 for 10% off selected trainings. I've really enjoyed teaching some of these modules. The other instructors are excellent. I really think if you're looking for good training, you should check them out. You've heard Reid and myself reference our work on psychedelic clinical trials a lot on the show. Well, we're excited to announce that we've begun enrolling participants for the Compass Pathways psilocybin trial, investigating the combination of psilocybin and Compass's psychological support model for treatment-resistant depression. So if you're interested in participating or you just want to learn more, you can go to the link in the show notes or directly to numinous.com/research to learn more. If you'd like to support the show, you can do so by subscribing. So whatever podcast player you're listening to, if you're watching us on YouTube, you can subscribe to the show. You can leave us a rating or review in places like Apple Podcasts or Spotify. And of course, you can share the episode with someone you think might need to hear it. And now I give you our conversation on people-pleasing. Here we are yet again. Another episode of Psychedelic Therapy Frontiers. How are you doing, Reid?
Let me see if I could be truthful. Not bad.
Yeah.
A little tired, hoping to get some energy here right now. It's been a busy short week, but happy to be here. There's a nice pause from the day to day.
Yeah. I feel like, you know, these conversations are energizing as much as they are draining. I mean, it's a hard thing to do, to be informative and hopefully entertaining and useful to our listeners. But I always feel kind of charged after we do this.
How are you, Steve? How's your heart?
My heart is good. You know, I'm in a good place. I feel grateful for all the many things that I deserve and don't deserve that I have in my life. But yeah, doing really, really well. In fact, you referenced my heart. Today, we're going to talk about something that is near and dear to my heart. It's something that I think about a lot, something I reflect on a lot, something I have grappled with personally, and that is the burden of being a people pleaser.
People Pleasing Anonymous Club.
Yeah, we should start that. People Pleasers Anonymous, PPA.
Yeah, as I was seeing what the interwebs have to say about people pleasing, it was interesting. And the internet, the world gets like this, tries to make it black and white. Like, people pleasers are X, Y, Z. You know, because they self-sacrifice, they're depressed and they're this, low, like insecure, da, 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 da.
Yeah.
And it hit a little button in me. I was like, because like you, I'd identify as a people pleaser, like working on that, coming from generations of maybe self-sacrificing. And I see the good in the trade and I see the struggles in the trade, and it's been a journey. But I just wanted to maybe start by pointing out that it's a spectrum, like life, like most of what we talk about. We're all on it somewhere, including these associated factors, like, you know, whether or not one is insecure. We're all insecure in some ways,
I really appreciate you pointing that out, because we've talked about it in other ways with other topics. But human beings, we like clarity for the most part. It's one of the reasons I think labels appeal to us. A lot of us like to reject labels, of course, for all the right reasons, but...
And sometimes the wrong reasons, too.
Yeah. Yeah. It gives us a sense of, like, this is what's going on. Or if you have a feeling that something's wrong with you, it maybe even gives you some hope. Like, oh, there's a name for this thing. And other people might share this thing that's been a blight in my life.
Looking for love in all the wrong places. That just came to mind.
A song.
Reese is now going to free associate here for the rest of the podcast.
Okay.
So whatever comes to mind.
So, Steve, what is a people pleaser?
So, people, in my mind, a people pleaser is...
First, my name's Steve.
I'm Steve. I am a people pleaser. No, people pleasers are folks who have a tendency to put their needs on the back burner in favor of meeting the needs of others. And it tends to be motivated by, like you mentioned earlier, insecurity. Like, the only way that I'm going to prevent rejection or judgment or criticism and get what I want, connection, belonging, intimacy, affection, acceptance, is by making sure that the people around me are pleased. And pleased could mean making sure that their emotions are all positive, making sure that what they ask is granted. So it is sourced from typically sort of an insecurity around your own worth or an uncertainty about your own worth. And so you're hoping to assuage that never-ending fear that you are worthless or unlovable or rejectable by making sure that everybody else around you is well taken care of and pleased.
Yeah, yeah. And this might be a good segue into just, well, I have two or three theories, examples of where it might come from. Mm. Like there's an old saying in therapy or joke of, if it's not one thing, it's a mother. That stems from the unfortunate blaming mothers era.
Yeah,
but what I like about that inappropriate joke is that just the importance of early life and parental relationships, definitely not just the mother, but the mother is often the most attuned to the child. But this applies, I think people apply, pleasing equally applies to both parents. But say you're a kid growing up in a household like most of us did or do, and hopefully this is shifting, where our parents' response to feelings was dismissive, mm-hmm. right? And it might be, if you feel different than them about something, the response might be to dismiss it, minimize it, change it. And that, that can create the conditions to take on a sense of my feelings aren't important. So
right.
As one common place it can come from.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, just do the thought experiment. Imagine you're a young kid and you have a few basic needs that you're trying to get met. And you're doing the social psychological calculus as you're interacting with your primary caregivers. Like, you need to make sure that they don't abandon you. You're trying to get love and affection, feel secure and safe, right? And the affection or the attention or the acceptance that they're giving you is inconsistent.
Mm-hmm.
And so you're trying to do that math, like, okay, how can I ensure that I get what I need? And you notice that when you are compliant or when you are convenient for them or when you are happy, that you're getting more positive attention. Then when you do feel those emotions that either they are overtly telling you don't feel, like stop crying, or you just notice they withdraw and they're less available to you when you're grumpy, then you might start suppressing some feelings and you might sort of spontaneously come up with this strategy, this mm-hmm. very understandable strategy or defense mechanism, call it what you want, to get those things that you need. And you mm-hmm. become a people pleaser as a result.
Behaving in a pleasing way is reinforcing in many households. And to take it to the next level, like if you have a rejection early in life, like say an emotionally unavailable parent, kids can start attempting to please more and more for that approval. It's interesting if you look at the different variations of a list of what are our core needs as humans, to be seen, to be heard, to be understood, to be celebrated, to be loved and cared for. And like, it's just interesting that that's an interpersonal kind of list.
Mm-hmm.
And they all touch into this. Like, you see why we were wired to seek those things for survival and thriving.
Yeah. I'm glad you brought up survival, because even though that's an interpersonal list, I think as social primates, if we were rejected or abandoned by the family or by the group, the troop, the tribe, then you died, right? I mean, there weren't a lot of successful, survivable lone wolf strategies back in the hunter-gatherer days, I would imagine.
Yeah, like it it wasn't every time that the baby in the basket was recovered and raised by royalty or whatever.
Right.
Yeah. So then the maybe third theory, and this is just not an exhaustive list, just as I was thinking about this morning, is like if a parent can't emotionally self-regulate and they might naturally go into a victim stance or a blame stance towards kids of like their emotions or their preferences. If they take those on as a burden, it can be unsafe for the kid to have preferences, feelings, and needs.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I like that you're implying there could be a lot of different early childhood milieus that result in people-pleasing. Like, it could be that the parent is actually really well-meaning and wants to be there for their kid, but let's say the parent has a chronic illness or something like that, and they just, because of that illness, they need to retreat a lot. And so the kid's trying to figure out, like, again, how do I get that love and attention, affection I need? Well, if I'm really, really, if I'm of service to my ill parent, then I get those connections.
Yeah. And this isn't just being nice on one kind of lighter end of the spectrum, and this isn't being totally codependent on the other end of the spectrum. I think this is a broader category that many, if not most people, can identify with, right? People pleasing by a show of hands.
Right.
Who's got it?
So I'm looking at, speaking of lists, I just, similarly, I was thinking about this and just jotted out a few characteristics or things that people pleasers on this spectrum sometimes demonstrate. So like I said earlier, they're trying to prevent criticism, judgment, rejection. They're often very conflict avoidant.
Mm-hmm.
And they'll over-ascribe fault or responsibility for that conflict to themselves. So they have a tendency to apologize a lot, even when it's not clear that they have anything to apologize for, or it's obvious that it's not their fault. Some people will even default to "I'm sorry" in ways that sound kind of odd, right?
You see it all the time.
Yeah, so over-apology. They're not really great at boundaries. Specifically, if somebody, you know, asks something of them, their default is just to say yes.
And overextend at your own expense, at the expense of your needs, your wishes, your hopes and dreams.
Right. Yeah. And there's often this covert subconscious contract where they hope that by being this way, that there's going to be reciprocity, right? That they're going to get back a lot of, like all the things I've said before, affection and whatever. But and so when they don't get it back, because they're basically training other people to discount their needs by being so self-sacrificing. Or they're in a relationship with a sociopath or a narcissist who's more than happy to take all that is being given. They find themselves feeling very unfulfilled or resentful. Like, people pleasers can be angry and seething on the inside. And oftentimes they'll react to that feeling by being passive aggressive. Mm-hmm. So like you said, it's not always just sunshine and rainbows, niceness. Sometimes they can get a little aggressive as a result.
Yeah, I think that's a good litmus test for differentiating between these things. Like, being nice is generally accepted as a good thing. Yeah. And people pleasing is generally accepted as a common thing needing work.
Right.
And how do you know the difference? And one filter to put it through, I think, is it maladaptive or adaptive? And it, including that example you brought up, that's probably one of the biggest risks we fear, is growing resentment. And another thing you mentioned was like triggering the behavior you really aim to avoid in someone because of these unconscious, subconscious, semi-conscious forces at play.
Right. Yeah. I think another quality is rejection sensitive dysphoria, that because there's that deep-seated toxic belief that I am unlovable or something's wrong with me, when rejection does occur, they go through, and I say they, like, I'm talking about me in a lot of ways, go through this process of like, hey man, I've been a good boy. I've done all the things to make sure that there's no conflict or I don't get rejected. And so when something like that happens, you can be very dysphoric and sometimes explode a little bit. Like, all of a sudden you get this person who has this nice demeanor. They've been known for their niceness, and something doesn't go according to their plan, and they can get even a little nasty, or at least really, really upset.
Yeah. And it reminds me of, kind of as an aside, I think what's called the Carpan drama triangle.
I haven't heard of that.
This is from the, like, a couple decades ago, but it shows up in the book and workbook Codependency No More has been around a while. I think an important work. And it's a tool in, like, in the transactional analysis of interpersonal psychotherapies, for example, but it's basically has a triangle that shows the three shifting roles that we fluidly move between in drama intense situations of, like, the victim, the persecutor, and the rescuer. And the unclear boundary thing you mentioned is at the root of it. And it's really interesting in the spirit of awareness to look at intense situations from that lens and see, because sometimes we don't always default into that victim stance.
Right.
Or we might be taking, especially as people pleasers, taking on the rescuer role. And sometimes even the persecutor one without even knowing it.
Right. Yeah. I think this conversation about boundaries is really important. And sometimes when I think about my own people-pleasing tendencies or people-pleasing generally, I think about this, that people-pleasers often don't know who they are because they have outsourced their value or really even outsourced the defining of who they are to others, right? By default, they don't feel really, really good about themselves.
Mm-hmm.
And so they want to be shown or told or want to be revealed by others that they are worthy and they are good for a variety of reasons. So where they stop and another person begins is often very unclear to them.
Mm-hmm.
So it does make sense if you think about it that way, that they would be more preoccupied with pleasing other people, not only so that they could get all the nice things and connection that I mentioned earlier, but also so that they could be shown and told who they really are. Like, what is my value? So you can imagine if you don't have a good independent grasp on your own value as a person, that you could be very, very vulnerable to people-pleasing tendencies.
Yeah, maybe you can help me reconcile some semantics. Just like with what you're sharing, I completely agree with. And it's also just bringing up this dissonance in me of the self-compassion literature by Kristen Neff and many others, of the three components of it. One of them is, what is it? Common humanity. Kindness, common humanity, and mindfulness. And the common humanity, I think, stems from, especially Kristen Neff's leanings of towards Buddhist psychotherapy and this idea that in people pleasing, you can get caught up in the illusion of a false sense of self. I think the root of suffering, and I'm maybe answering some of it myself, is the root of suffering from a Buddhist lens comes from the illusion of separation. And it's different to think about one's own self-worth than one's sense of separate self in need of like that's being treated as a victim or something like that.
Yeah, I think when you see yourself as separate or as different, and then default to I'm separate and different because I'm bad, then, I mean, it would make sense that if you could dissolve that boundary and see yourself in this common humanity perspective as no much worse or better than the other person.
Yeah.
That you maybe wouldn't be as susceptible to the people-pleasing tendencies.
Yeah, I think that's why she put it in there is because it's geared at this need to see that we're not alone in it. And it gets at the perfectionism that is correlated with people-pleasing from these childhood things we mentioned, for example, of needing to behave perfectly in a chaotic environment or unpredictable environment or whatever.
Right.
But once you take a stance of everyone fails, it's okay, then you get into more self-compassion and less self-criticism. And I think I see self-compassion as one of the three main factors for me at work of working on people-pleasing is like you need some awareness, you need some healing of the wounds of the past, the experiences, Like, you got to feel it to heal it. You got to accept it. You got to let it go. And then self-compassion to, like, fill our cup enough to know that we don't have to endlessly chase approval, acceptance, and love from others like a hungry ghost because we have it inside of us.
Right.
Yeah. Because we are it.
Yeah. Exactly. Like, and I totally agree about self-compassion. And this idea of non-separation, I think, is like you're saying, a really important piece to that puzzle. Because it's easy to say or to think about it cognitively. Nobody's perfect. Or everyone, another way to say it is, everyone has imperfections. But you have to believe that you are an everyone. It's really difficult for us to do that sometimes, right? We'll beat ourselves up. And sometimes I'll have my clients go through this exercise where I have them imagine that that everything that they're saying is being said by a close friend or a child. Mm-hmm. Put them in front of you. What would you say to them in response? It's never the stuff they say to themselves.
Yeah. Why are we raised to be kind to others, but we're not taught to be kind to ourselves? Mm-hmm. Any ideas?
I mean, I imagine there are certain cultural aspects, modern Western cultural aspects, that are old holdovers from, I don't know, I'm thinking about my British grandmother and, you know, the irony and self-loathing that comes from that culture. And I'm not sure like what the origin story is, but
grin and bear it.
Yeah. And there's this idea of pull yourself up by your bootstraps and, you know, you are responsible for everything that happens to you in your life and don't inconvenience others with your negative emotions.
And the self-criticism is not visible to others like it is when a kid is critical to another and gets reprimanded.
Yeah. It's hard to believe that our species would have lasted as long as it has if self-loathing was like one of our defaults as organisms, right?
Yeah, but self-criticism seems to be a variant of the drive for doing things in an excellent way, gone awry. Like people-pleasing, I kind of see as a superpower potentially gone bad because people-pleasers are highly attuned and can be really well liked and pleasant to be around, etc.
Yeah, that's a great point. When I've grappled with my own people pleasing and trying to change the negative aspects of it, I have that thought sometimes, like, well, wait a second, I'm pretty well liked. Like, I mean, maybe some of you listening to this are like, I don't like you, Steve. Well, let me know. I would love to please you. Please let me know so you don't hate me. No,
everyone write into Steve.
I don't have a lot of like sworn enemies in this world. And some of that is because I've made a concerted effort to please others.
Do you wish you had more enemies?
No.
Do you think you should?
Should's a strong word, but I think it would be nice if I could be more of myself.
Unapologetically
myself, without the intense fear that being unapologetically myself would result in complete annihilation. Right. Yeah. And that's just me being as vulnerable as possible. I don't think that on a regular basis.
That would be liberation that's the goal, right? To be able to be uniquely you and not carry the burden of excess fear of abandonment and that, you know, if I don't get this approval, it's not going to be okay.
Yeah. And I think that doesn't come from not giving a shit about anybody else.
Yeah.
Right?
That's a different thing.
That's a different thing. It comes from then truly loving and accepting who you are.
I love these paradoxes, these fine lines to walk, like people pleasing being a good example, like an example of when good traits can go bad and lead to someone's burnout or lead to someone being self-deceived and accidentally like ending up lying to yourself and others about what you feel, what you need. You start to lose your authentic self, maybe even forget who you are. You start to dim your own light. There's a lot of risk on the far end of chronic, unchecked people-pleasing and self-sacrificing at one's own expense. That, you know, isn't only good. It's not just a selfish, it's not a selfish pursuit to work on people-pleasing because it is a gift to tell others the truth about how we feel. Yeah.
Yeah. You know, an argument could be made that to be an unbridled people pleaser is a selfish pursuit. because you're in some ways you're being, and speaking from my own experience, sometimes you're being dishonest about what you think, how you feel. You're putting honesty on the altar of being liked. And sometimes saying what you really, really think is a beautiful service to yourself, but it can be a service to somebody else. If your priority is to make sure everyone in your life is happy, it's going to be hard for you to give somebody some, I don't know, some constructive feedback that they really, really need, a friend who needs a wake-up call, that kind of stuff.
I remember a therapy session I had once, just in the spirit of doing my own work. I was doing a course of therapy with a different kind of approach, more of that psychodynamic, almost psychoanalytic feeling. And I don't know how we even landed on people pleasing, but I remember some of the reflections and insights that came out of one session in particular. It was a wake up call to see that, oh no, when I'm people pleasing and someone to avoid discomfort, when someone is sitting in their own dog crap, I think they said in the session, then you are really just enabling them to stay longer in their own dog crap.
Yeah.
And it's not doing them a favor by not telling the truth about something you disagree with on important matters or something like that.
It makes me wonder if people pleasers generally have a lower tolerance for negative emotion, like negative affective states in themselves and in others. My guess would be yes.
Yeah, so if you plot people pleasing on the attachment quadrants, the attachment style, like there's often a spectrum of anxiety and avoidance layered onto that. And if you have high avoidance and high anxiety, you know, you would certainly be in either of those anxious attachment or avoidant anxious attachment styles.
Yeah. I think one of the ways I think about these attachment styles, like the preoccupied, anxious, ambivalent attachment style is characterized by sort of negative beliefs about self, but more positive beliefs about others. Like I was saying earlier, it's you sort of defer the final word about your worth to the opinions of others because you don't have a good grasp on it yourself internally.
It's and people pleasing, like you kind of pointed out, is not narcissism, right? Like, you know, everything is interconnected eventually, and there are some overlapping, a lot of overlapping domains in this area. But it's definitely built on an empathy and compassion that goes too far from those unconscious forces.
Yeah, I think that's an important thing to point out is that I think a lot of people pleasers at their core are kind, compassionate, attuned individuals, right?
Yeah.
It does come from a loving place, at least partially. When it's very malignant, or to use your phrase, when it's very maladaptive, I think it's generally coming from this terrified, wounded place of lack, of lacking, of insecurity, which if you've ever been in a relationship with somebody who's like a real strong people pleaser, you can see it, and it can even be obnoxious. Like, I want you just to tell me what you want. Don't agree with everything I have to say.
Yeah.
Don't put the burden on me to make all the decisions. Like, I want to know you. Like, I want to be in a relationship with you, and that involves disagreeing on some things. I want to know who you really are. So tell me, even if it might upset me, we'll navigate that on the other end.
Yeah. There's this saying I read once that stuck with me, one of those things that was just seared in my consciousness. It said, never do anything that would make yourself or others feel small.
Mm.
And I took it to heart because I agree with it. Mm-hmm. Like, and it makes sense on both fronts. Like, you know, we don't want to do that to others, of course. And we don't want to make ourselves small. That's not what the world needs. That's not what we need.
Yeah. I like that a lot.
Yeah.
That's a good compass to calibrate to.
Yeah. Sure. So why work on this? We talked about some of the signs, but what do you think? What's your big picture view?
Yeah. Well, I can tell you what working on it has done for me. So, working on it has helped me get a better sense of who I really am, you know, and who I quote unquote really am I don't know that there's like some treasure box that eventually you open psychologically that reveals to you your true nature. I think that's a work in progress all the time. Mm-hmm. But when I stopped as much calibrating to what other people wanted from me so that I would be liked, and instead getting really, really curious about, well, what do I actually think about this? What would, if there was no potential consequence, like no risk of rejection and hatred and judgment in this interaction, what would I actually say? Mm-hmm. So it's helped me know myself a lot better. And it's also helped me feel more confident. Mm-hmm. So, and I've had a lot of clients that I've worked on with this too. Just the simple act, the art, the science, the practice of saying no and allowing no to be a complete sentence has been relieving after it was terrifying, mm-hmm. right? It's been tremendously relieving. I'm less neurotic, less preoccupied, less anxious, more confident, more courageous.
Yeah. Yeah. You fill your cup so you can share that with others, right?
Yeah.
And it does build confidence. It does build reserves of that good stuff you can share. And to make it less daunting, sometimes I like to break it down in like, what are some little things you can do? Like try saying no, try accepting a compliment and saying thank you instead of dismissing.
Yeah, that's a big one.
Try stopping yourself every time you want to say sorry and checking like, is that warranted? What did you just do? Mm-hmm. Did you just take up some space in the world? Like, is that what you're saying sorry about?
Yeah, the compliment one. I'll encourage people or suggest if somebody compliments you and you deflect it, if I want to get really dramatic, I'll say you're doing violence to that person, mm-hmm. right? They gave you a gift that they want to see land on you. They want to know that they're having a positive impact on you. That's why they're giving you the compliment, most likely.
You smacked it back at them.
Yeah. So you're like, thanks for this pie, and you throw it in their face. That's not going to be very pleasant. But if you say, thank you, that means a lot to me.
Yeah.
Then you're giving them a gift right back. You're giving them the gift of having a positive impact on you.
And you know what I've noticed in myself as I've worked on this over the past several years is in working with clients, when I model this kind of thing, when I say no, or when I really express a true feeling or need, it gives them permission to do the same.
Right.
It gives them a corrective experience of being able to do the same and not feel instantly abandoned.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. On the apology front, you know, one thing that when I supervised budding clinicians, and let's say they're running a few minutes late and it's understandable, right? They've got a client in crisis. They need to just spend a few more minutes with wrapping up the session. And sometimes I would see young clinicians be overly apologetic. I'm so sorry, you know, and I'll give you more time on the back end, whatever.
Yeah.
Instead, I suggest they just say that they express gratitude, right?
Yeah.
Thanks for your patience. Really appreciate you being on time.
Yeah. Sometimes this happens.
Yeah. And certainly you don't want to be defensive or diminish anything that you have done wrong. We're not saying that in order to recover from nice guy or gal syndrome, you just never apologize again. But there is a difference between being nice in the way that we're describing from a people-pleasing perspective and being kind. So back to your cup analogy, if you are willing to make your cup a priority, right? Make sure that you get the rest that you need, that you fulfill the dreams that you have, that you work on yourself, and your cup gets full, then you can serve from that cup judiciously and generously. And it doesn't come from this weird, it doesn't have this weird energy with it of like, oh, I need something back from you.
Yeah.
There's a huge difference in receiving generosity from somebody who's just giving with no strings attached versus somebody who's giving out of desperation because they need your validation.
Yeah. It's more transactional in the latter.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. It reminds me of this saying that I encountered during my emotion focus therapy training a while back that struck me because I liked it and didn't like it. It's the saying that I love you, but I love me more.
Oh, I remember you telling me that. Yeah.
There's something about that triggers in me, probably one of my people-pleasing parts, to be like, I'm not going to say I love myself more than others. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? But there's an important message cutting through all that and the semantics and triggers is, you know, there's something important of that in holding our own boundaries with love and for the betterment of self and others together.
Yeah.
Within that common humanity.
Yeah. I think it's, we, as people pleasers, we need to be careful not to conflate self-love with selfishness, right? Not to conflate self-love with a narcissistic preoccupation with our own needs.
Yeah.
They're not the same, right? Self-love is something that we deserve, like anybody else deserves. And like we've been saying, it unlocks your ability to truly be present with another person. If I genuinely don't need anything from you, Reed, in this moment, then because I've got it all already, then I can be so free and flowy and generous with you in a conversation, right? But if I'm like, I really worry about what Reed thinks about me, and so I gotta engineer this conversation so that he pays me compliments, or mm-hmm. I have to engineer this conversation so that it's clear to me that he likes me, then it would be really hard for me to stay totally present and yeah. tuned in.
Yeah, it makes perfect sense because our minds thinking of all the like transactional components, overthinking, worrying, etc. Yeah, energy directed to the wrong places mm-hmm. rather than present moment, you know, love, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I came across something recently. I'll just ask it to you as a little quiz. What percent of people do you think are self-aware by, say, academic definitions of aware of you know, not perfectly, but have some basic awareness of our both preferences, needs, and behaviors and what drives us.
Yeah. Oh man, I imagine there's a ton of nuances to self-awareness yeah. that we could dive into, but how many people are self-aware in the way that you describe? Gosh, I hope it's more than 50%.
10 to 15% in yeah. this one study or survey. And like you pointed out, it all depends on how we define and measure, but it wasn't that shocking to me. Like we talked about it last time, mm-hmm. the need to know thyself, but awareness is not only the greatest change agent, but a prerequisite to change things, because you in general cannot change what you're unaware of.
Yeah. Yeah. I was reflecting on what I've decided are my like four primary values in life the other day. And it's an acronym cool. I came up with called LAAF.
Oh,
L-A-A-F.
Nice.
So love, authenticity, mm-hmm. awareness. So this is what, you know, prompted me to remember this, and freedom. So awareness, I think, is paramount. It's self-awareness is really, really, really important. Of course, you and I are mental health professionals. We're in the self-awareness generating business. It's hard yeah. to address things that we're unaware of. It's hard to understand the inner workings of our psyche if we haven't turned the spotlight of consciousness onto those inner workings. So yeah, I think, and I guess just riffing on the people-pleasing topic, it would be difficult to know that this is a problem if you weren't aware of where it came from and what the costs are.
Yeah. Like our good buddy Carl Jung said, until you make the unconscious conscious, it will drive your life and you will call it fate. Yeah. And I'm paraphrasing, but
yeah,
I mean, he spoke it in another language anyway.
Yeah, drive could have been dictate, whatever.
Yeah. Dictate, yeah. Yeah, so other things I like to try on as little practices of, like, try disagreeing sometimes mm-hmm. as a practice. Like, pick wisely. You don't want to be that person mm-hmm. that just disagrees with everything for the point of, but I mean, next time you have a preference, state it, of where you want to go eat.
Yeah.
Or next time someone's saying something, you know, just find a way to respectfully, with love, disagree.
Yeah,
and see how it feels. Yeah,
I like the way you edited that. Is next time you, instead of just like arbitrarily disagree, mm-hmm. next time you have a preference, state it. I think that's awesome. If you've ever been in a circle of friends where nobody's willing to take the burden of deciding where to go to eat, it can be really obnoxious. I don't know. Where do you want to go? Where do you want to go? Where do you want to go? And so I, like years ago, took that on as an experiment. I generally don't have strong preferences about where to eat. I'm a trash compactor. I'll eat whatever. Mm-hmm. But if I had just like one, if they gave us a binary, like let's go to this place or this place. And I was able to let go of what I would normally do. And that's like, well, what do I think they want to eat?
Yeah.
I'll pick that place. I'd be like, what do I actually want to eat? And then I'll be like, all right, let's go to this place. And it was so uncomfortable. So uncomfortable for me to like be the guy who decides where to go. Cause what if they don't like the food?
Yeah.
What if somebody isn't stating their preference and then they're angry at me? Cause it's like, well, I didn't want to eat there anyway. Why did Steve pick this place? I had to grapple with all that stuff.
Yeah.
But you know, I've comforted that little inner child, over many repetitions of this behavior, and it's become a lot easier and pretty gratifying actually.
Yeah. Yeah. That's beautiful. And people pleasers do tend to try and anticipate the needs, expectations, response to things in others mm-hmm. by nature of the beast.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's what makes it a double-edged sword, like you were saying earlier. Like, I think our ability to pay really close attention to and anticipate the needs of others probably on the positive edge of that sword make us good clinicians, make us decent partners to be in relationships with, make us decent friends, right? Well, yeah. Likable people for the most part, but it can go too far, like we're talking about.
Yeah. So maybe we could chat about boundaries a little more, because it's an important topic of its own, but comes into play on the people pleasing, self-sacrificing front in a big way. And I'm just thinking of how I like to work with people and boundaries sometimes, of looking at boundaries as taking an inventory of your boundaries as rigid, healthy, or overly porous, mm-hmm. you know, and you can see the risk of rigid boundaries that might avoid closeness, you know, be overly protective of one's vulnerabilities. And the porous boundaries are what we're talking more about in people pleasing, of like over-involved in others' problems, difficulty saying no, getting pulled into things we really don't want to, or the things people could do themselves. And we've just stumbled into a dynamic where that's how it is, the unconscious contract.
Right. Yeah. I wonder if the sort of those more rigid boundaries might correlate with avoidant attachment style. I mean, they're both insecure attachment styles. And like we were referencing earlier, perhaps the product of some early childhood experiences, you know, the combination of that and your particular genetic code, the phenotypes that get expressed, whatever. But
We are all a mix of all these types of boundaries, porous and rigid and healthy, mm-hmm. and with our own unique mix. And it's also different according to the setting. Like you might have a rigid boundary at work due to whatever it is, your life experience or temperamental makeup has landed on, or the other way around, but it might be very different in close, intimate relationship too.
I think that's helpful to know, because then if you are trying to change any of this about yourself, you can pick a context mm-hmm. where you feel a little safer to experiment. So like if you're really terrified at work and your boundaries are super porous because you're like afraid of being fired or whatever, then maybe that's not the place to experiment with the boundaries just yet. But if you have a friendship that feels generally safe and you could do the where do I go for dinner type experiment, then maybe pick that one.
Yeah. And as you pick these boundaries to look at, I think it's important to also pass it through that question we were talking about earlier of, are you doing this, overextending in order to win approval, to shore up weak self-esteem, or like, are you pursuing the happiness of others at the very real expense of your own?
Right.
Because that can be really deeply ingrained.
Right. Useful question to ask yourself. And then of course, a nice helping of self-compassion if you find yourself, you know, not quote unquote doing it right. I read a book a while ago by a guy named Aziz Ghazapura called Not Nice. Hmm. It's a big book. But the whole book is dedicated kind of to this idea. And in there, he has his five pillars of being not nice. Hmm. And of course he makes the caveat that not nice does not mean unkind or selfish. Right. And so we're talking about a few of them here, but his, just sort of to validate how we've approached this topic. He says the five pillars are: have boundaries, own your shadow, speak up, say no, and be more selfish. And again, he qualifies what he means by selfish. He's not saying be a jerk. So have boundaries, own your shadow, speak up, say no, and be more selfish.
Yeah. It reminds me of an example we've talked about maybe on the podcast before, but I remember crossing the bridge once upon a time of this question that was both bubbling up in me and coming at me reflected by others of, is immersing yourself in a yoga meditation practice selfish? Mm. And like, as I really dove in deeply to that, I had to answer that for myself. You know, understandably, is this a worthy pursuit according to my values and everything else? But it was just interesting to land so clearly for me anyway on like these practices are actually an unselfish thing for me, like selfish in the way that that book probably uses it, mm-hmm. of like holding healthy boundaries of self and healthy self-love for the betterment of life for all of us in this shared self.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a great example. I've heard other sort of aphorisms about this. Like if you don't set your priorities, other people will be more than happy to set those priorities for you. If you don't set your goals and trajectory in life, then you're going to be working on the goals and trajectories of somebody else. And mm-hmm. who better to know where you want to go and what you need than you? That when I say that, though, the you that is the core self, you maybe from the IFS perspective, the fully actualized you.
Mm-hmm.
So it's tempting to defer, like I was saying earlier, to everybody else to tell you where to go if you're scared and uncertain. But mm-hmm. I think what should we call it? Enlightened self-interest. Like I'm curious about how you arrived at that conclusion that the yoga and meditation was not a toxic, selfish act.
Yeah. So it fits into this equation, I think, of how to create the conditions to transform something like this. Awareness, you got to see it first. You've got to heal, accept, let go of the past, and you need self-love or self-compassion. State it how you will, and that's the filling of one's cup, the doing the things that fill your cup, including like making you feel good, build confidence, and even just for a break, a recreation, a rest. And that can create these conditions. But for me, it was one of those levers to pull on, like filling my own cup, mm-hmm. that helped complete the equation. Yeah.
Yeah. I think for me, I love the cup metaphor. And when I could make the connection between a full cup for me means that I'm actually showing up in my relationships way better than I would be if I were just shaving off pieces of myself left and right. That appealed to like my inner altruist. Like I really do want to be a quote unquote good father and good husband and good therapist, all those things. Like that's pretty core Steve stuff.
Yeah.
So what helps me do that? Taking care of me, making sure that I am a priority.
Yeah. And that's an important thing to realize and not easy to land on. Sometimes it takes some time. You brought up parenting and I wanted to ask you what your thoughts are on the relationship between people pleasing and parental guilt. You know, just something that like, you know, areas I know we've both been immersed in through life.
Yeah. So like a people pleasing parent and feeling guilty as a parent.
Yeah. Just like the parental guilt of needing to be there and everything to everyone and perfect in your parenting. Yeah. Like we could explore the same around partnership, but I'm just thinking of my own journey through parenting and wondering how it's been for you.
Yeah. I think one of the things is assuming responsibility for your child's life generally, mm-hmm. but their struggle more specifically. So times in my life when I've been sort of a less self-aware, parent, I will see my kids struggle and then immediately assume it's because I'm doing something wrong
and try to fix it for them.
Right.
Yeah.
Which does a disservice to kids. Fixing it for them doesn't give them a chance to learn their own competence by going through a struggle.
Change your own diaper.
Yeah, there you go. Make your own dinner, two-year-old. Or you run the risk of being selfish by trying to spare them from negative affective states that could be really important for them to feel. We talk so much on this podcast about emotions and the important messages that they bring and feeling it to healing it, to heal it and all that stuff. But that's pretty hard to do. In fact, it's harder for me to do that with my kids than it is for me to do that with my clients. I can sit all day long with a client who's experiencing intense negative emotional states and understand the utility of facilitating that expression and help them work through it. But man, when it's my kids, it's just harder. And I think I'm making this realization right now in real time. I think it is because of that sort of parental guilt that sometimes I feel as a result of having this false responsibility for making sure that they're happy all the time.
Yeah. Like I've noticed the guilt, like even if I'm going to work on some kind of fitness or whatever to fill my cup in some way or fulfilling a duty in the world, in the workplace, it's easy. Like as an example, it was my youngest daughter's birthday yesterday, Emily. And
I saw the picture on Instagram. It was beautiful picture.
Oh, thank you. So yeah. beautiful girl, beautiful kids. And I got to celebrate with them last night and it was so heartwarming and cup filling, but, I had got invited by my dad who was making pancakes for my daughter for her birthday and her sister. And I couldn't go because of a psychedelic study training that was mandatory and planned long ago to that in particular, but it's just interesting to witness the guilt come up of like, oh no, I have to be here instead of there. Even though like there are plans, that she's probably and very likely totally okay with and fully accepting of. I know there's a lot of nuance there of like, you need to check in with yourself of what's okay in that regard. But I just know from experience, it's so easy to, for people pleasing to run amok in the parenting department because we care so much.
Yeah. Because we care so much. I think there's a version of that that's a little more malignant. And that is, again, back to this idea that as a people pleaser, I need everyone else around me to be happy because if they're not, it's a reflection on my worth. Yeah. And so if you point that at your kids and you see a kid being upset as like, oh, I'm doing something wrong as a parent. And so you are quick to, you know, solve all those problems, then because that's a selfish act, right? It's really not about the well-being of your kid, not entirely. In this specific example I'm talking about, it's more about your comfort. I need to make sure my kids do not experience any negative emotions because I can't tolerate it. So no crying in this household. Kid comes from school and then school was the worst day ever. And you're, well, what was a good thing about today at school? You know, you're trying to help them focus on the bright side, but by doing that, you're also invalidating their experience.
Yeah. Yeah. And I'm thinking of what you just said and the example I just shared and how, there's really an easy solution, to at least part of this, of if you're feeling sad about not being able to get somewhere, but feeling to be somewhere, but feeling clear, about what you need to do and that you're fulfilling both these roles in the best way you can, you know, when in doubt or as a general rule, why not speak that? Mm-hmm. Like, you know, I am sad that I can't be there and I can't wait to like for at this hour, but I can't wait to spend time with you a few hours later. And then, you know, that's more of that recipe for presence in both settings.
Yeah. I think that's great advice. Yeah. Speaking it out loud. Also grief, I think, allowing yourself to grieve mistakes and missed opportunities. Using grief strategically like that, I think can be really, really healing. Instead of just, it is unacceptable that anything bad happens, right? Bad things are going to happen. And when they do, because you know they will, you grieve the chaos of the universe. This might sound a little weird and a little esoteric, but that's something I've used a lot in my own life is like doubling down on grief being an okay thing to experience and inevitable.
Grief is cleansing. Yeah. And in this formula for working on it that I've shared, you know, we talked about the awareness, but on the healing front, I think it really is that with the light of awareness, And with these loving intentions, you take an inventory of how you show up and where these may have come from, if you can figure it out, and the past wounds and the dynamics, and you've got to accept them. Sometimes that's speaking it or writing it, or because if only 10 to 15% of humans are mostly self-aware, then we are all self-deceived in some ways, often many. And so it's the antidote to that. But then once you get there, you've got to set it free on the wings of forgiveness and letting go. Yeah. So you can really be unencumbered, be like liberated and free, like you said, to show up as you.
Yeah. Yeah. Forgiveness is crucial and often very difficult to do.
But, yeah.
I'm thinking of some other books that I just want to make sure I shout out, that if people want to dive deeper on this topic, I mentioned Not Nice by Aziz. The other one is No More Mr. Nice Guy by Robert Glover. This is kind of a classic on this particular topic. I've read that book a couple times myself. Don't agree with everything in there. I'm sure there are outdated things in there that might not pass the political correctness test of our modern era, but don't throw that baby out with the bathwater. There's a lot of good stuff in there, particularly for men. Mark Manson's book, The Subtle Art of Not Giving a Fuck, is a great
one. It's a good one, yeah.
It's a good one on anxiety generally, but it does talk about some people-pleasing.
Catchy title.
Yeah. Yeah, he won the catchy title lottery. I was listening to an interview with him the other day, and he just kind of talked about how he landed on using swear words like that in his titles and how that worked out for him, and a lot of copycats and whatever. But those are a few that I think are pretty good if you want to dive deeper.
Yeah, yeah. I'm thinking of like even some of Brené Brown's work on like the gifts of imperfection.
Yeah.
I think that's a helpful one. Like, she has these guideposts for wholehearted living that she's presenting in a slightly different way or different angle, but I think they're so important, because some of those guideposts are letting go of what others think, letting go of perfectionism, letting go of the need for certainty, of exhaustion as a status symbol, as like, you know, shooting on ourselves, as always being in control and trying to control how others feel too.
Yeah. Which is great advice. And I've had clients ask me in response to almost all of those, how do I let go of control? How do I let go of my need for control? How do I let go of my need to be liked, or how do I stop caring what other people think?
Yeah, these are good questions. That'll have to be for another episode.
Well, I'm or just re-listen to the entire first part of this episode, because we are talking about how, you know, generally, and
yeah,
you know, we would be remiss not to mention psychedelics in an episode of Psychedelic Therapy Frontiers.
Oh, but yeah.
You're even wearing the shirt today, Psychedelic Therapy Frontiers. But yeah, and I've certainly, not that psychedelics are required for this kind of work, hardly at all, but they can be very, very powerful tools of awareness generating, like you said earlier, but also this feeling of oneness with others. Mm-hmm. Right? We mentioned boundaries and feeling separate. It's not uncommon in a psychedelic experience, particularly with something like psilocybin or LSD or DMT for that matter, to feel at one with everyone and everything, and also I've been calling them toxic beliefs, to have them sort of set aside or peeled apart and see your value. I remember having a client with an eating disorder and lots of self-loathing in a ketamine therapy session say, this was the first time in my life I could view myself as a lovable being.
Yeah, I've seen that so much.
Yeah, it's amazing.
It's beautiful. It's, yeah, so touching, like brings tears to see that happen. Yeah, as you mentioned psychedelics, I'm thinking back to this like three-pronged approach or formula that I'm talking about, of like personally approaching this, of awareness. Do psychedelics help with that? Can they, if used wisely? Yeah. Mm-hmm. How about healing? Yes. Mm-hmm. Right. Mm-hmm. If used wisely with the right intentions and setting? And how about self-compassion and self-love? Yeah. So, and under those, like, can it help you see the common humanity? Yeah, that's a mystical experience questionnaire section in some ways. Can it help you cultivate mindfulness? Growing body of evidence, a single dose of psilocybin, you know, not only occasions of mystical, but can, you know, increase mindfulness in so many different areas. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So, I think the answer to your question or you bringing it up is a good point.
Yeah. Certainly powerful and useful tools.
Not just because it's in the title of the podcast.
Yeah. It's also relevant, guys. Even if our podcast wasn't, it was just like cool stuff with Reed and Steve, we would still likely reference psychedelics as a useful tool in this, to this end.
Yeah. It reminds me of a quote I like from Lao Tzu of like, at the very center of your being, you know who you are. Mm. Or something like that. Mm-hmm. But it's true. Like, what if you were to sit in silent stillness for 5 minutes a day and try to learn about yourself in all these ways we're talking about? Like, there's a challenge I'll throw out because it can be game changing, especially if approached with some deliberate intention. Yeah.
Yeah. Go get to know yourself, folks. I saw this, this YouTube video the other day where these scientists had constructed the quietest room in the world. So all these sound panels and sound absorbing things. And, and they were seeing how if people could tolerate it, just being in a silent room with no, it's dark too. It's pitch black.
Is this like the silent darkness retreat?
Not the retreat. This is just a study. Yeah. People, I mean, darkness retreats are kind of trendy right now as an altered state and, you know, an ordeal to put yourself through to learn about yourself.
Like a long float tank without the salt water or whatever.
Right. Yeah. Right. And trippy stuff happens when you're in darkness with no sound, but it reminded me, I don't remember who to attribute the quote to. You'll probably remember, but, you know, a lot of men's problems are because they can't sit quietly with themselves or whatever it is. You know what I'm talking about?
Oh yeah. It's, one of my favorites and that I've never drawn a blank on the French philosopher, Camus.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. I might be wrong. But if I'm wrong, I will accept it. Yeah.
You don't have to be perfect, Reed. It's okay. I still like you.
Yeah, because deep down, I know I used to know the answer, and it's okay if I'm getting old. Just kidding.
There you go. Acceptance and awareness. Yeah. But I've often thought, like, how would I be in that environment just being with myself? So, and I've done plenty of silent meditation, and it in the effort to get to know myself, it can be uncomfortable. So I guess we'll make that caveat to our suggestion for people to go get to know themselves. Like, buckle up. It could be a little uncomfortable, but so worth it.
You know, our podcast producer, Jamie, who happens to be sitting over there, sent a study the other day of, like, people would prefer an electric shock over sitting absolute silent stillness. Yeah, I still need to pull the study because I'm intrigued, but it definitely made me think of that quote that we've woven into at least two episodes in the past because if all of our problems stem from that, maybe we should look at it. if it might be true.
All of our problems? Wow. What about climate change? Yeah. I don't know.
Because we're out there not sitting still, hurting the planet.
There you go. There you go. All right, folks. There's our stab at people pleasing, and Reed and I are still on the path of recovery. I'll be going to
join
my
us
meetings.
Yeah, join for the us next meeting.
There you go. Thanks, Reed.
Thank you, Steve.
Psychedelic Therapy Frontiers is brought to you by Numinous, a mental wellness company committed to tackling the global mental health crisis by delivering best-in-class psychedelic-assisted therapies, contributing to the body of primary and clinical psychedelic research, and fostering healing through community connection and social responsibility. You can learn more about Numinous at numinous.com. That's N-U-M-I-N-U-S.com. If you enjoyed the show today and you want to support us, here's how you do it. Rate and review the show on platforms like Apple Podcasts and Spotify. Subscribe to the Numinous YouTube channel, like the videos, and share it. Share the show or clips of the show with someone that you think will enjoy it. Hey listeners, it's Steve Thayer here, letting you know that Numinous offers unique training opportunities for mental health practitioners to develop their skills and expertise in offering psychedelic-assisted therapy to clients. These courses are carefully crafted by Numinous professionals like myself, Reed, Joe, and others, and offer a variety of high-quality learning experiences. So, if you would like to learn more about these trainings, you can find the link in the show notes below, or you can visit numinous.com/training. That's numinous.com/training. The content of this podcast does not constitute medical advice or mental health treatment. Consult with a medical or mental health professional if you believe you are in need of mental health treatment.